Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Hello? Dr. Jessup? Anybody here?
Well, hello, good sir. I'm glad to see you have arrived. I apologize I can't be there to greet you in person, but please know that I am most appreciative of your attendance. So hard to find good volunteers these days. It's as if every undergraduate with even a bit of backbone has simply vanished in the past 6 months.
Uh-huh. Okay, so am I in the right place?
Ah, well, perhaps instead you should ask whether you were in the right time.
Uh-huh. Well, the flyer said you were doing $6.25 an hour for test subjects in something called Middle Cambrian Exposure. Not sure what that is, but if you're paying cash, I'm still on board.
Excellent. Now tell me, do you have any experience with time displacement?
Don't think so.
Of course not. Of course not. And tell me, can you swim?
You know I can, but it's one of those things. I wouldn't say I'm a great swimmer.
Well, nobody's perfect. Now, do you see the throbbing, lightless vortex in the center of the room there?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I do.
Excellent. Go to it.
All right.
Yes, yes. Closer, closer.
Something doesn't feel right. What's that feeling?
Ah, what's the matter, my little vertebrate? Haven't you ever wanted to feel 500 million years younger?
What is that? Is that an ocean? My God, it's like the whole planet's an ocean. It's full of monsters!
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Robert, that was obviously a reference to some kind of journey we may be taking to the Cambrian period.
That's right. Yeah, we had a little cameo by the late, great Anton Jessup.
Late? Did he die?
I don't know. I mean, there are rumors of his death, but who knows for sure.
They always exaggerate those. Well, anyway, today I've got a little story I want to tell to lead us into our topic. Now, obviously, it is October. It's our favorite time of year to talk about monsters. We talk mm-hmm. about monsters anyway, but this is the time where we really double down on
monsters.
Yeah,
we have a clear mandate for monsters.
And I got to take a monster science adventure this past month. So this past month, early on one Sunday morning, my wife Rachel and I were in Canada, and we woke up before dawn on this Sunday morning in the town of Golden, British Columbia. That's in western Canada in the okay. Canadian Rockies. And we had some coffee and bagels, and we filled up our backpacks with a bunch of layers of warm clothes, bottles of water, all that hiking stuff. And we drove along these steep mountainsides to this tiny town called Field in British Columbia. And there we parked beside a gas station, and we waited to meet our guide and the rest of this tour group. So the guide was a paleontologist named David, and the hiking group was mostly French-speaking families, some really lovely people, and some very intelligent children with great questions like, why do animals die? And so we hiked through the town of Field and along this uphill path through the forest up the side of Mount Stephen. And as we went on throughout the day, the trail got steeper and steeper, and we could see through the trees the town we came from was becoming this tiny miniature model in the distance. And then right around midday, we came out of the tree line, and we walked up on this bare plain of flat rocks. And they were pieces of the underlying shale formation that had chipped and broken off, and they'd gathered in this relatively flat part of the mountainside. And on this plain of rocks, you walk around, and you pick up these mineral fragments, and they're full of fossils. It's just fossils everywhere. Almost every other rock you find has the shape of an animal from millions of years ago printed into it. You're literally walking on thousands and thousands of fossils.
Oh, wow. So you're in this mountainous environment. And David, who, by the way, I'm picturing as the android from Prometheus and Alien Covenant, is guiding you and showing you these prehistoric remnants in the rock.
David was not Michael Fassbender, but David was excellent. He was a really, really good guide. And this place we came to where we were walking on fossils, this was the Mount Stephen trilobite beds. It is a graveyard of organisms from the Cambrian period, about 500 million years ago. Now, Mount Stephen is in an area that's home to the Burgess Shale Geological Formation, which is one of the most important sites of Cambrian period fossils in the world. And if you ever get a chance to do one of these hikes, I highly, highly recommend it. I think it literally might be the coolest thing I've ever done. You have to book them through this organization called the Burgess Shale Geoscience Foundation, and they pair you with a guide. Our guide, David the Paleontologist, was an excellent science communicator. He was really good with the kids on the group, and he was a great hiking guide. So if you get a chance to go with David, big thumbs up to him. Be warned, if you do try to do this, it's a tough hike. It's like 8 kilometers round trip horizontally with a 795-meter elevation gain, which is like 2,600 feet. And that's starting at like 1,200 or 1,300 meters of elevation at the base of the mountain. So the air is thin, and it's worth doing some other hikes at higher elevation to get yourself accustomed to the lack of oxygen. But I also don't want to scare you too much. Obviously, I am no kind of athlete or experienced altitude hiker or anything like that, and I survived. So
you're advising listeners to wear their best flip-flops on this particular hike. Okay.
Just be prepared. Have some layers, have some water, do a little practice. If you can make the trip, it is absolutely worth it to see these fossils firsthand. You can pick them up. You can feel the ribs of these Cambrian organisms. You can feel the contours of their bodies as they printed on this ancient shale. But also, it's really cool to be there just because the area around Field, including Mount Stephen trilobite beds and the Burgess Shale quarries, are just arguably the most important Cambrian fossil sites in the world. They're a geological window into a time stranger, I would argue, than any alien planet in any movie, any book, any video game, any Star Trek episode. I think the real alien monsters, and of course, if you know this show, you know we use the term monster affectionately. Mm-hmm. It's not a pejorative. The real alien monsters are not out there on some exoplanet. They were right here 500 million years ago. And in this one amazing place, you can sort of crunch through their frozen graveyard, and it's awesome.
Now, Joe, do you find yourself falling into the same admittedly dumb trap that I do when I think about about the nationalities that are sort of overlaid regarding fossil finds.
Oh, these are Canadian Cambrian monsters.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Like, yeah, because I was recently reading to my son about pterosaurs and was reading about about Bavarian fossils of pterosaurs.
Uh-huh.
And as silly as it is,
uh-huh,
I couldn't help but think of Bavarian pterosaurs, thinking about Bavarian prehistoric creatures.
They're like wearing lederhosen, yeah, with a big, big stein of beer.
And it's so unfair. You know, I've done the same thing thinking of Mongolian fossil finds. In our previous episode, we talked about various raptors, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if it was the Velociraptor or Deinonychus, but I could not help but then think about them in terms of like human history regarding that area.
Right.
And then
like
kind of slap
they
myself
ran with
for
Genghis Khan.
Yeah.
Part of his pack. Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And that does highlight the need to sort of explain how the Cambrian world was so different than our world, not
mm-hmm
just that it had different animals in it, but that planet Earth was different then. So when I say it was an alien planet, I mean that quite literally. It's not just that it had different fauna.
Yeah.
It was a totally different place to live. And so before we get into exploring these monsters of the Cambrian period, these beautiful and bizarre creatures that you couldn't even dream up if you tried, I think we should take a look at the Cambrian period itself and explain what it was like to be Terra 500 million years ago. So the Cambrian period lasted from about 540 to about 485 million years ago. And if you were dropped from today straight into the Cambrian period, you would not recognize planet Earth. The Earth, for one thing, revolved faster than it does now. So days were only about 21 hours long, and there were about 420 of them in a year.
Huh.
The air would be hot, so the average global surface temperature would have been about 10 degrees Celsius hotter than today. That's a good bit hotter. The atmosphere, while it did have significant free oxygen at this point, was not quite what it is today. It would have felt a little bit thick with carbon dioxide in your lungs. If you happened to see dry land, it would probably look more like the surface of Mars than Earth today, because land-dwelling plants didn't exist yet. Kind of hard to imagine Earth that way.
Mm-hmm.
And without plant roots to hold the soil in place, land surfaces eroded very easily in the wind and the churning water. So, you know, the continents are constantly just kind of burning away into the oceans and being reformed.
So to call back to a previous episode we did, this was definitely a world before fire.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because what would it burn, right?
Yeah. I mean, I can't be sure it was totally without fire, but I mean, yeah, obviously not fire on the scale we see of wildfires mm-hmm in forests today, because there was oxygen in the atmosphere at this point. But yeah, what would burn? What would the fuel be?
Right. All right. So we have this alien world with just a barren land when visible. And then we have this ocean, this
right
strange ocean.
And the Cambrian Earth, that's not a story about land at all. That is a story about ocean. It
mm-hmm
was the ocean planet at that point. You could probably make the argument it's the ocean planet right now, but it definitely was then. According to Cambrian Ocean World, Ancient Sea Life of North America by John Foster, the level of the seas rose steadily in this sawtooth rise and fall pattern throughout the Cambrian period. So at the beginning of the period, sea level was actually a little bit lower than it is today. But by the end of the late Cambrian, sea level was about 160 meters or 530 feet higher than it is today. So in today's terms, New York, underwater. Rome, underwater. Paris, underwater. Baghdad, underwater. Even parts of Moscow, underwater.
Oh, wow.
And the high sea level in the Cambrian led to flooding of about 40% of the area of Earth's continental masses. Compare that to today, where only about 5% of that continental area is covered in water. So most of our planet's dry land mass was gathered together closer to the South Pole, and the continent that became North America was then called Laurentia, not then called by people who lived then, but people today called that continent then Laurentia. And you sort of have to imagine North America turned sideways, mostly flooded, straddling the equator. Also adding to the alien quality, in the Cambrian, astronomy would have been a little bit different. So the moon was more than 20,000 kilometers closer to Earth then, meaning that its gravity was stronger, meaning the high and low tides on Earth were higher and lower.
Ah, Okay. You know, my son was just talking to me the other day about the size of the moon in prehistoric times.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like he knew that the moon was bigger in prehistoric times?
Yeah. And knows that it will be smaller in future times.
Did he intuit that or did he find that out somewhere?
He consumes a lot of like Dinosaur Train, and he really likes this podcast, Wow in the World. It's a great science podcast for kids. So, and then, you know, we talk to him a lot about science.
But. Man, I wish I was that cool when I was a kid. I probably just would have told you about like which Ninja Turtle was bigger in prehistoric times.
Yeah, so far Ninja Turtles will probably come in and wash it all away. But for now, he's really, really into the science.
Like an alien ocean driving away the continents. Okay, so if we looked under that ancient ocean, that's where the real craziness comes in, because we would find this vast realm of gorgeous, terrifying, surreal monsters that would look completely unlike the kind of Earth life we're familiar with today. Because the Cambrian period is the geologic layer where we see evidence of one of the most fascinating and mysterious events in the history of life on Earth, known as the Cambrian Explosion. So, explosion. What exploded? Was this like a bunch of volcanoes or something? No, the Cambrian Explosion is a story about biodiversity. So, Robert, how old is the Earth?
Oh, it's, 4.5 billion years old?
Yeah, that's the general astronomical idea. Hmm. So, 4.5 billion years old, we've had this planet, roughly. And we know there's been single-celled life on the planet for at least maybe 3.5 billion years or so, based on fossil traces left behind by these organisms. And new findings keep pushing the debatable frontier of earliest life farther and farther back into the darkness of Earth time. One example I just came across the other day, just earlier this year in March 2017, there was an article published in Nature arguing that apparent microbe fossils in the Nouveau-Aigoutouc Belt in Quebec are about 3.8 billion and possibly 4.3 billion years old, somewhere in that range. And these single-celled life forms would have been surviving around hydrothermal vents and had this biochemistry based on eating and excreting iron.
That's pretty rough and tumble.
That's like a comic book villain, right? Yeah, the Iron Eater. And the crazy thing is that if these findings are correct, life on Earth would have began within just a few hundred million years of the planet first accreting together in space. It's kind of hard to believe. But whether life on Earth began like 4.2 billion years ago or more recently, we know that for a long, long time, life on Earth wasn't becoming much more complex, right? There was no serious multicellular life, so no animals, no fish and reptiles, no birds, no plants, no mushrooms, just microbial organisms like bacteria and archaea floating around in the oceans, forming mats and films, and occasionally building these giant mineral brains in the surf called stromatolites.
So this would be, if this were a science fiction film, this would be the least cinematic alien life form encounter, unless it made people like, you know, horribly sick, obviously, or possessed them.
Biofilm planet.
Yeah.
Yeah. The planet of slime.
Yeah. This would be the episode of Star Trek that does not make it to the series.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that would have been the story of Earth for most of Earth's history, mm-hmm. not having any kind of interesting animals or anything like that. Not to say that microbes aren't interesting in themselves, but maybe less interesting to look at. It would have been slime planet.
Yeah. Generally, this is the stuff that occupies one, maybe two pages of a large prehistoric life book.
Yeah.
Before you get on to the more exciting things, the things that children can imagine fighting each other.
But it's most of the life that's ever happened here. And then, billions of years later, at the beginning of the Cambrian period, something happens very suddenly. Loads of insane animals show up. And when I say suddenly, I have to qualify that. That's suddenly from a geological point of view, which in reality means it took millions of years, about mm-hmm. 540 million years ago to about 500 million years ago. But that's still pretty sudden compared to the age of the Earth. And this geologically rapid spike in animal diversity delivers creatures with bilateral symmetry, with large bodies, with eyes, with legs, with shells, with segmented body parts. You've got all of these crazy different types of creatures suddenly showing up, and it's like, where did they all come from?
Yeah, it's like all these prototypes are rolled out at once. It's like the segment in, is it RoboCop 1 or 2, where we get all the crazy prototypes? That
Oh, that's RoboCop 2.
Yes, yeah.
One of our favorite points of comparison on the show for biology.
Yeah. Yeah, you have suddenly all these different, you know, seemingly crazy examples of life, and many of which don't seem to fall in easily into that category of, well, this is a precursor to something we have later on, it's a precursor to something we have today.
Now, of course, for some people with negative attitudes towards evolutionary science, this provides some kind of rhetorical ammunition, right?
Indeed. I mean, the explosion is often exploited by evolution deniers. Even Darwin, we have to note, thought that the explosion was at odds with the normal evolutionary process.
Which, in a funny way, could be true, but not in the way an evolution denier would mean. So
right.
A couple of thoughts. Evolution, as we're familiar with it today, tends to take place within ecosystems in which every niche is already filled.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, every way there is for a creature to make a living, there's already something trying to do that. So if you want to compete, you've got to outcompete these other organisms. The global ocean of the Cambrian, on the other hand, represented a world in which it seems like there was still tremendous ecological opportunity to occupy, like there was territory in the ecology that didn't have any existing competition. So it was a time in which an animal could start doing something to eat or to otherwise survive, and no other species was already doing that thing. There was just sort of like free land to grab.
Yeah, land grab, call the frontier. Except without other organisms already occupying it.
So that there could be one explanation for why evolution seems to be working differently at this one period in history than it has since. But also, the young Earth creationist who exploits ongoing debates in biology to sort of resort to the supernatural, they're employing a fallacy in rhetoric known as the argument from ignorance fallacy, which means like, I don't know what caused something, therefore the cause is
right.
X. Example, you don't know who committed the Jack the Ripper murders, therefore it was interdimensional Sasquatches. Now, the version employed here, of course, says you can't all agree, we don't know on what caused the sudden or geologically sudden biodiversity of the Cambrian explosion, therefore the cause is supernatural. Now, this line of thinking obviously doesn't get you anywhere once you examine it, but the disagreement and debate over the cause is a fascinating, outstanding question, and it's something I think we want to entertain a few answers to today. Now, some of the hypotheses are primarily environmental and chemical, right? So some scientists have proposed that the cause of the Cambrian explosion could be a rise in the content of oxygen in the atmosphere, which leads to an increase in the level of dissolved oxygen in the oceans. Now, of course, remember that Earth's original atmosphere did not have free oxygen, right? That was added to the atmosphere gradually as a waste product of photosynthesis. So you have all these microbes out there, and they're eating the sunlight, and then they're geoengineering the atmosphere with their waste products, which included oxygen.
This is the gradual natural terraforming of our world.
Yeah, yeah, the microbial terraforming of Earth, which absolutely did happen in the past, and that's where we get our oxygen. Now, when you think about it, large, fast-moving animals need lots of oxygen to feed their energy-hungry tissues. Like, think of the way that when you move your muscles a lot, your body starts greedily gulping down more and more air. In the same way, if you think about these organisms in the past, suddenly you wanted to have organisms with large bodies, they would have needed access to oxygen. So maybe when that oxygen became available, suddenly you could build these big, fast-moving bodies and you get all this animal biodiversity.
Okay, so previously the oxygen economy would not support this kind of growth.
Right, but the idea is then it would.
Mm-hmm.
So did a sudden increase in oxygen drive the explosion? Well, some recent studies have cast doubt on this hypothesis, including one published in Nature in 2015 by Sperling et al., and it basically did not find evidence of a significant increase of oxygen in ocean water at the beginning of the Cambrian. So evidence shows that if there was an increase in oxygen at the Cambrian transition, it was kind of a small one.
All right. Well, what else do we have?
Well, other hypotheses are more biological and ecological. Like, what if there was one type of biological innovation, some new way for animals to make a living, or new thing animals could do that rapidly accelerated competition within ecosystems, which would speed up natural selection and cause new species to form much more rapidly? How about the example of sight?
Oh, yeah, this is a big one.
Yeah, so previous animals, they might have had some kind of photosensitive spots or receptors that would have allowed them to, for example, move toward the sunlight. But the Cambrian is the first period in history where we have evidence of complex sight organs, you know, eyes. It's the age of organisms with compound eyes. So imagine how much adaptive pressure would be put on you if you lived in a world where all creatures were basically blind, and then suddenly some of your competitors could see.
Yeah, this is a crazy thing to try to imagine. But yeah, just think of sight coming online in a world and all the additional stuff that this entails. Suddenly, pigmentation begins to matter.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to even apply – one is tempted to apply this to a human arms race, which is often an apt comparison. But, I mean, what can we even look to in human technology and human weapon systems? I mean, I was thinking maybe you could apply it – you can compare it to flight and say that, well, once human technology allowed us to take to the air, that created an entire new theater of war, and then also changed the existing theaters of war.
And I think you could make that comparison pretty well. Like, flight changed the nature of warfare forever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, suddenly just having like lots of ground troops didn't matter a whole lot.
Right. But this seems more extensive than that, you know? It's like it's the opening of another dimension of competition in a way.
Yeah, and you think so. You mentioned pigmentation.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, the colors you are matter. Like, blending in matters, but also think about the way it would make movement matter.
Mm-hmm.
It would make the shapes of bodies matter. It would just completely change all the dynamics of how creatures interacted with one another.
Yeah, not only prey predator interactions, but of course just interspecies communication, and as well as mating, etc.
Yeah.
I mean, everything changes because of this.
Yeah. So we'll come back to look at more of these answers to this question throughout the episode. But I think we should take our first break, and then when we come back, we will look at one of the first major inhabitants of our Cambrian monster house.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product, and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
All right, we're back. So as we roll through these, I also want everyone to think of potential Halloween costume ideas.
Oh.
Because I think we have some wonderful prehistoric monsters here that I think our more inventive listeners might be able to turn into a mask or a full body costume.
Okay, so I want you Starship Troopers fans out there to get a little bit excited about Stonebug Planet.
Okay. Fans of the book or the movie?
Well, I mean, they both got bugs.
That's true.
Okay, so in 1886... there's a Canadian geologist by the name of Richard McConnell, and he's visiting the town of Field, the same town I went to when I began the walk up Mount Stephen, Field, British Columbia, where some railroad workers told him they had found something creepy on the slopes of nearby Mount Stephen. They were these things that they called, quote, stone bugs. And these were, in fact, trilobites, the best known inhabitants of the Cambrian Oceans. Now, trilobites are not a single species, but they're a class of extinct animals from the phylum Arthropoda. And so that would be the same phylum that includes, for example, insects and crustaceans. Lobsters are arthropods. Insects and spiders are arthropods, these exoskeleton creatures. Now, trilobites were an enormously successful form of life, beginning in the Cambrian and surviving for about 300 million years until they were wiped out about 250 million years ago in the Permian-Triassic extinction event, also known as the Great Dying, which was the biggest mass extinction in the history of planet Earth. About 95% of all marine species went extinct. It's kind of hard to imagine.
Yeah.
But until then, trilobites were like sort of like the insects of today, just this enormously successful type of creature found everywhere. They were a swarm upon the face of the deep, or as I kind of want to think of them as the infinity bugs.
Ha, I like it.
So the trilobite body structure kind of resembles like a roly-poly or a pill bug, maybe crossed with a horseshoe crab. It's got these articulated segments lining its back. And if you look at it from the top down, you'll see this flat, hard shell made of a matrix of tiny calcite needles. And if you look at it on the vulnerable underside, you'll see the legs and the gills and the mouth. And actually, it does kind of look like a roly-poly or a pill bug on the underside, too, if you ever see them.
Yeah, I have to say the trilobite of all the creatures we're going to discuss today, well, first of all, it's the most famous, I think. So most of you have probably seen images of it before. Mm-hmm. But it also does look a lot more like existing creatures. It doesn't if you didn't know better, you could easily see an image of this and think that it could be something living today.
Yeah, I think the creepiness of the trilobite world comes not from seeing their body plans, because you can see stuff that looks kind of like them, like mm-hmm. you say. It's just how many of them there were, and thinking of this being one of the dominant body plans on the planet.
Yeah.
Or and, the dominant body plan on the planet.
And if you're still drawing a blank as to what this looks like, I'm going to include images of all the species that we're discussing here on the landing page for this episode at stufftoblowyourmind.com. All right, so we've had a look at the creature's legs.
Mm-hmm.
Let's turn this puppy around.
Okay, turn it. So if you look at it from the top down, you can basically divide a trilobite in three both ways. So if you look at it lengthwise, you're mm-hmm. looking at it head on lengthwise, there is bilateral symmetry. And this is in the Cambrian period, we see these animals with bilateral symmetry really taking over. You can fold them in half and they're like a book. They match on both sides. And in that lengthwise direction, the trilobite is divided into three lobes. You've got the axial lobe, which runs down the middle from the head to the tail, kind of like the spine of the book or like mm-hmm. the spine of a vertebrate. And then you've got the two pleural lobes on each side, which are shielding the legs from above. There were these, you know, shelled lobes stick out on the side to, and they cover up where the legs would be moving underneath. Now you rotate it 90 degrees, and then you've got another three sections. You've got the head, known as the cephalon, the middle section, known as the thorax, and the rear section, known as the pygidium. Now, one thing you might wonder, why do we see these articulated segments on the shell of a trilobite? Like, why doesn't it have something more like a big, solid turtle shell? You know, why the different plates overlapping?
Yeah.
Well, there are multiple answers, but one is that apparently some trilobites were able to partially curl up and protect their soft underbellies like an armadillo or a pill bug.
Yeah, or roly-poly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you use the word pill bug or roly-poly? I think they're the same thing.
They are, yes. I believe they're the same creature or the same, classification of creatures at the very least. But yeah, I grew up with roly-poly.
I think I did too, and somehow in my adulthood transition to pill bug, I've sold out my childhood wonder.
It does sound significantly less silly.
Well, anyway, trilobite fossils are that's what you're walking on in the Mount Stephen trilobite beds, right? So you walk around, you crunch through these things, you pick up these rocks, and they've got these little shells in them. And the trilobite fossils are so common, you can get the sense that these animals must have been stacked a mile high when they actually existed, right? There were a lot of them in the Cambrian, but they're perhaps overrepresented in the fossil record because many of the fossilized shells we find are not the animals themselves, but the discarded shells left over from the molting process.
Okay.
So like arthropods today, trilobites were hemmed in by this protective shell, and if they wanted to grow bigger, they had to molt, which meant discarding that protective outer layer and temporarily risking a soft-bodied existence in order to grow that larger, harder shell.
It would be like if there were a prehistoric hominid creature that left multiple skeletons behind, you know, which is, of course, impossible. But with an exoskeleton is very possible.
Well, the vulnerability of molting makes me think about the comparison to a human newborn. You know, when babies are born, they don't necessarily have all their hard, protective skeletal parts yet. And you have a lot of unfused together, the unfused skull, for example, and the soft cartilaginous body parts where you really do make yourself vulnerable when you're first born. But of course, they're depending on the fact that mammals have protective parents that'll try to prevent injury to their offspring when they're young and vulnerable. Trilobites, I don't know if they're quite so protective of their young.
I mean, you could say that puberty is kind of a molting period where we tend to be soft and vulnerable, if not in
mentally,
body, then at least mentally, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's interesting to think of the molting process having an impact on the sheer number of fossilized remains. But then on top of that, of course, it makes you analyze, and we've discussed this on the show before, like what makes a creature more liable to be fossilized.
Right.
And you look at the creatures that are fossilized in any great number, it's not going to be an apex predator living in a dry region. It's going to be something like a low-level invertebrate that lives in the muck.
Yeah, something that gets buried quickly and that leaves behind hard body parts near water especially.
Right. So the great land squid of old have not been preserved.
But their beaks are many.
Oh, yes. That's right. We would get the beaks.
Yeah, these beds of beaks, and we'd wonder what they are. Yeah, but because there are so many trilobite fossils and because they're so strange and so alien to the modern life forms we encounter in our day-to-day lives, I mean, they might bear some resemblance to insects, for example, right? And this is why a railroad worker might call them stone bugs. Mm-hmm. But it's no surprise that they show up in human culture, too. I wanted to mention one cool example I came across. Remember Adrienne Mayer, who wrote The First Fossil Hunters? We talked about her in our geomythology episode?
Yes. This had to do with how did ancient people look at fossilized remains? Did they think they were monsters? Did they think they were dragons?
Yeah. Yeah, and did these ideas of mythical monsters come from people finding fossils? Mm-hmm. So she's got another book called Fossil Legends of the First Americans, and she writes of how trilobite fossils were apparently used as protective amulets by some of the Ute people of Utah. So this one story is that in the early 1900s, there was an amateur natural historian named Frank Beckwith. And he noticed a trilobite necklace at a Ute burial site. So he asked some friends of his named Joseph and Tedford Pikyavit, who were members of the tribe, what this meant. And they told him that the fossil was called Timpe Kanitsa Pavachi, which meant little water bug in stone.
Huh.
And Beckwith also records that the men told him that their elders believed that wearing the trilobites could protect against sickness and bullets. But I thought that's kind of cool that somehow the fossils were intuited to have been water-dwelling creatures. And I wonder how people would have figured that out back then. Huh. I don't know. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, especially given that there would be plenty of terrestrial invertebrates to compare it to. I guess maybe they saw more of the crab in this creature than they did, terrestrial bugs.
Yeah, I know I wouldn't have been that perceptive. I would have called it like roly-poly or something.
Yeah, that's true. Huh.
Well, anyway, considering that there are all these shells everywhere, another possible answer to the question of what caused the Cambrian explosion comes up. What if the Cambrian explosion is an illusion?
Hmm.
What if it is not so much an event in history where all these animals suddenly emerged, but a misperception created by the types of evidence available to us?
So this would be like a reporting error.
Exactly. It would be a sampling bias. How would that be? Well, like we've been talking about, we know fossilization has this serious preference for hard body parts. And it appears to be around the Cambrian period that biomineralization, right, the forming of these mineral-based body parts like skeletons and shells, that became common in many different animals. It's the age of shells and exoskeletons. So it could be that many animal forms had precedent in the Precambrian era, that there were animals sort of like them living before, and it's simply that we don't have good records of them because they weren't making hard body parts yet.
Hmm. Okay, so this makes sense. So it's not that just suddenly there are all these creatures around with their hard shells. There were plenty of creatures around beforehand. It's just those were not preserved. Those are not as present in the fossil record.
Right, because they didn't have the hard shells.
Right.
Yeah. On the other hand, even soft animals leave some fossil traces like tracks and burrows. And generally, I think paleontologists think that these types of fossils are not as abundant as they would seem to be if the Precambrian world was basically a soft, flappy copy of the Cambrian. But either way, this leads us to a kind of new way of framing the Cambrian question. If the Cambrian explosion is characterized as this explosion of animal body plans, and especially those with hard body parts, why do the hard body parts show up? Like, where do they come from? Why evolve shells? And this leads us to another possible answer to the cause of the Cambrian explosion. What if it was caused by a biological innovation like predation?
So you have all of these creatures that have evolved, and then suddenly they realize, hey, we can just eat each other.
Right.
I can just eat these guys. Why should I compete for the same meal when I can make them my meal, and then I'm essentially eating what they already ate?
Right. Why would I waste my time filter feeding when I can just eat Ted over here? Yeah, so Eric Sperling, the Stanford paleontologist who is the lead author on one of the papers I mentioned earlier in this episode, he explained in a Nature News article earlier this year, or actually no, it was last year, that he thinks a very modest increase in dissolved oxygen could have been enough to push the ocean chemistry over the edge to allow for the emergence of predation and carnivory as an ecological niche, which would have thereafter driven evolution across the animal spectrum as this arms race between predator and prey emerged. In a world of predators, you need shells and you need to be able to move.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, this sounds plausible.
And there's some evidence that this is what was happening. Here's an odd fact. Sometimes trilobite fossils are missing chunks. Not because the fossils have been damaged, but apparently because the animals were. One example, a specimen of the trilobite Olenoides found in Walcott's quarry at the Burgess Shale has this distinct W shape missing from its left side, as if something took this kind of two-fanged bite out of it. So in this alien ocean, and you have to imagine me in the voice of Ripley in Aliens, who's laying the eggs, what's taking the bites?
Out of these trilobites. Maybe it's less dramatic if you put it that way. But yeah, there's got to be something else out there, some sort of predator that is chomping down on these guys.
And this leads us to the second monster in our Cambrian monster house, the weird shrimp.
All right, hold that thought, because we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will get to know the weird shrimp, which is truly, unless you're already, you know, super familiar with this time period, I would say it's the first really alien creature of the Cambrian period.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Okay. So in 1892, a British-Canadian paleontologist named Joseph Frederick Whitteaves was trying to figure out how to classify some odd Cambrian fossils that looked like headless shrimp shells.
Mm-hmm.
You can look up pictures of these online, but you could see these 500-million-year-old imprints of these clawed tails and bodies. But the heads were always missing.
Yeah, they look kind of, they basically look like entrees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like somebody pulled the head off the shrimp mm-hmm. and served it to you in a little cocktail glass.
Yeah.
Now, he named the organism Anomalocaris, which means weird shrimp or strange shrimp or odd shrimp, however you prefer. Meanwhile, Burgess Shale pioneer Charles Walcott, who is the guy who the Walcott's Quarry at the Burgess Shale was named after, he collected and described a fossil of a different animal. These preserved remains only showed a large disembodied mouth, a thick muscular ring shape surrounded by a circle of jagged teeth facing inward. And Walcott believed this mouth to be the remains of a jellyfish that he named Petoia.
All right, so this would be the mouth of an otherwise soft creature. That was his argument, and all we have left is the mouth.
Right. And it wasn't until many decades later that researchers Harry Whittington and Derek Briggs figured out that these two weird anomalous animals were weird and anomalous because they were different parts of the same creature.
Ooh.
A huge Cambrian predator that retained the name of Anomalocaris. The weird shrimp were actually a pair of clawed appendages. basically mouth tentacles for snatching up prey and shoving it into the mouth parts. And the mouth parts were the toothy ring, which had previously been identified as Petoia. If you've never seen an image of Anomalocaris, this is another thing to look up. Well, or maybe we'll try to include a picture on the landing page.
Yes, yeah, yeah, we'll include a picture of this creature because it's just too weird. If need be, we will draw one and upload it to the site.
It's sort of like impossible to make yourself believe that this thing really existed on Earth, but I've seen the fossils now. And so the reason these disembodied parts were originally misidentified was a common problem in paleontology. As we've mentioned several times now, fossilization is strongly biased toward hard body parts like shells and bones. Anomalocaris did not have a hard exoskeleton covering its whole body, but probably had a very light chitinous outer layer like a shrimp shell on some parts of its body. And when it died and decomposed, its body probably fell apart into different pieces, and not all of those pieces were preserved at the same rate. So it's rare to find fossils that preserve any information about soft body parts, and even rarer still to find soft bodies intact all in one place. Rare, but not entirely impossible, because since the original discovery of what amounted to Anomalocaris' killing equipment, more fully preserved Anomalocaris specimens have been discovered. For example, one fossil discovered in 1992 shows these spiked feeding arms branching off of the head within reach of the crushing mouth ring and all contained within the imprint of this elongated soft body lined with lateral lobes that probably undulated to power swimming. So if you're trying to imagine this thing right now, you have to picture a kind of wide, flat, lobed jellyfish snake undulating along through the ancient seas with a gaping mouth ring on the underside that could squeeze with teeth but never fully close, and then sticking out of its face a couple of hooked fang tentacles lined with spikes.
Yeah, this looks like a creature that belongs in a Star Wars cantina.
Yeah. Yeah, it should be like having a drink and telling you it doesn't like you.
Yeah.
And it probably doesn't like you. Now, you might be thinking, okay, so how big were these things, right? Like a few inches long? Parts found in fossil sites in China indicate that Anomalocaris-type organisms may have grown to almost 2 meters long, which is around 6 feet.
Oh, wow.
People do those like booking a swim with the dolphins thing. Mm-hmm. I think people should book swim with the Anomalocaris. They should use some kind of DNA engineering to bring these things back.
Well, you know,
and then have you swim with them at the resort.
Well, you know, if the predation explosion hypothesis is correct, especially, I mean, this was eating other animals was a growth industry. So it does make sense that the successful model for eating other creatures would produce larger and larger organisms, right?
Yeah. So, but the question, I guess, is if these things are preying on the widespread trilobites of the ancient seas, I don't know. Would they take a bite out of you if they could?
Huh.
Like, so you're in the water with them. You obviously don't look or smell like their normal prey. But then again, they might just want to see what you taste like. It's hard to know.
We kind of get into that whole shark and gorilla area. I don't know if I've mentioned this on the podcast, but
I don't think so.
Well, every time I go to the ocean, I comfort myself regarding the risk or apparent risk of sharks and of course, just shark media in general by thinking about a brief clip on The Simpsons where a shark jumps out of the water and grabs a gorilla out of a tree, which is ridiculous for several reasons, but it drives home like this is something that does not happen and is not part of the energy model for either species, you know.
Right.
And that's essentially what I am. I am a gorilla in the water, and the shark has not evolved to eat me exclusively. It can if need be,
yeah.
But it's not out there looking for gorillas.
Right. It might have also, though, evolved a sort of like prey diversity curiosity. It might
True.
Take a little nibble on you to see what you're like.
Right, right. So I guess that would be the main concern. But I'm guessing you would have this element of surprise.
I don't, by the way, I don't mean to be promoting like fear of sharks. Obviously,
no.
We're not their primary prey.
Right. But I'm guessing with humans, if we were to go with our opening scenario and you were just dropped into the waters among these things, I would hope you would have this element of surprise over them, and they would be a bit shocked and uncertain and hesitant to approach you.
So another thing that's really cool about Anomalocaris is that they have these amazing eyes. For a long time, detailed evidence of non-biomineralized arthropod eyes had been hard to find, but in 2011, there was a letter to Nature that detailed this amazing find at the Emu Bay Shale of South Australia, and what they had found was preserved anomalocaris eyes. And they found that they had a pair of 2 to 3 centimeter eyes, about 515 million years old, and they were compound eyes made of at least 16,000 hexagonally packed lenses, meaning these eyes would have been about as acute as the most powerful arthropod eyes today, like dragonfly eyes. Huh. And the authors think that this is that this evidence of acute vision lends support to the idea that Anomalocaris was a powerful, fast-moving apex predator going all throughout the water column, which and this would have accelerated the arms race that triggered Cambrian biodiversity and biomineralization.
You know, this makes me wonder, though, would a creature like this have anything to fear? Like,
well, I mean, probably not. I mean, if it's the apex predator of an ancient ocean, it's the biggest thing out there and it's got the most powerful killing equipment. What does it have to worry about?
Nothing until, the time-traveling human shows up and starts clubbing them. I guess with that club they brought, you'd have to bring your own club. That's a key here.
But nothing dead will go.
maybe a still living tree branch will work.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, maybe. That somebody should have told Kyle Reese about that. I guess that wouldn't have been all that effective against a Terminator.
Yeah, where are they going to get a tree branch in the desolate post-apocalyptic future, right?
Okay, we're on a tangent here. So we're going to look at some more Cambrian monsters, but one more thing about Anomalocaris before we move on. There is still a fascinating debate going on about how and what Anomalocaris ate. So some of these wounded trilobites that we discussed earlier have injuries that really seem to match the two-pronged grasping appendages of the Anomalocaris, and some experts believe that its mouth parts would not have been powerful enough to prey upon trilobites with their hard outer shells. So that kind of creates a question, like, was it eating something else? Like, how could it have gotten through these hard outer shells? Mm-hmm. There are a few options. Maybe they were just really beefy and they could crunch through those shells. Maybe they had some method of prying the shells off of weaker trilobites and sucking up all the soft parts inside. Or there's also an interesting possibility I learned about from the guide on our hike, David. Maybe they took a tip from the crab shack down the shore and they sought out soft shells, trilobites who were in the process of molting. So you release your hard shell, put that aside to be fossilized for people to find millions of years later, and then you stay soft for a little bit while you grow. What if they sought those out, the molting trilobites, and nom-nom-nommed?
Oh, man, yeah. I mean, that could be the very niche that they are exploiting. When you turn to the model of eating other creatures, what better time than the molting period?
Yeah. Okay, so the trilobites and Anomalocaris-type creatures are some of the main players that we see in Cambrian evolution. But there are also all of these fascinating, bizarre periphery organisms. Like, Robert, would you like to take us on a tour of the rest of the Cambrian Monster House?
Sure. Yeah, we have some wonderful specimens here to discuss here. And there's not necessarily as much data behind all of them. I mean, there's data, but it's maybe not as sexy as the trilobite. However, they still have some fascinating features, and I think many of them would make excellent Halloween costumes.
I would say they're much sexier than the trilobite, maybe just not as robust.
Yeah. So the first one here we want to discuss is Opabinia.
I've often called the stalk-eyed vacuum Cenobite.
That's a good description, one that I think evokes the alien qualities of this creature. So if you're not looking at a picture of this right now on stufftoblowyourmind.com, I want you to imagine something like a shrimp or a lobster, but with rows of side lobes along its sides, paddling along like the oars of a galley.
Okay, so
like a Viking ship.
It's got these lobes on the sides, kind of like we described with the Anomalocaris,
right,
that undulate to move it along throughout the water.
Right. And, you know, it is not that remarkable at the end. Like I say, if you were just catching it, a glimpse of it out of the corner of your eye, the back portion doesn't look that different from, again, like a lobster or a shrimp or something. But it's the front end of the creature that is rather interesting because it has a long, flexible proboscis tipped with grasping spines. And the creature itself was about 3 inches long, not counting this weird, cool, reachy tentacle.
Yeah. Five eyes, too, right? Five eyes on stalks.
Yes, five eyes just staring right at you.
On stalks. Yeah. It's like they put them on stalks. It's like just to mess with us.
Yeah, I think this all sounds very Lovecraftian, but according to the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, a reconstructed image of the creature resulted in laughter at a 1972 scientific meeting. So instead of looking at this thing and thinking, oh, well, this sounds horrific. It's like got this reaching arm that you know is up to no good with its spikes on the end. But, yeah, apparently when it was first presented, other scientists laughed at the prospect of something this ridiculous looking.
So you have to think – so it's got this reaching appendage that's sort of like its mouth appendage thing. Mm-hmm. So what sort of like – maybe sort of like an anteater, I guess, but it's obviously not a vertebrate, not a mammal.
Yeah, it was, the idea here is that this would have haunted the soft seabed, and it would have reached into sand burrows with this you know, spike terminating wriggly arm to grab delicious worms.
Mm.
And I actually have a quote here. This is from H.B. Whittington from the enigmatic animal Opabinia regalis, Middle Cambrian, Burgess Shale, British Columbia. This was presented to the Royal Society B. Quote, Opabinia regalis may have plowed shallowly in the bottom mud, propelled by movement of the lateral lobes. The eyes are presumed to have been capable of detecting movements in the surrounding waters, and the frontal process to have been used to explore the mud for food and bring it to the backward-facing mouth.
The frontal process.
Yes.
That is the most amazing euphemistic term for killing equipment. And then they put the frontal process through the thorax.
The way that my son describes it with the animals when he's like drawing dinosaurs, he says, this is the part that makes the animal's eyes close and then die.
What?
Yeah. So,
the frontal process is the part that makes the trilobite's eyes close.
Yes. So this is a cool specimen. It's unique. It's enigmatic. It's silly looking, but it's also, you have to admit, a very sensible organism when you really think about it. It needs something to grab those worms. It has a single, grabber to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's also interesting that this one remains unassigned to any other extinct or currently living major group. There are some theories, but for the most part, this is one of those, abandoned prototypes you can think of. You know, there's nothing out there that we know of that is a descendant of this thing.
That's interesting because when I think about organisms like this, I think about the relationship between manipulation limbs and the evolution of intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's one way of looking at the evolution of hominid intelligence, and it's to say that, okay, one thing that may have driven humans and other, great apes to have larger brains and more intellectual power than the average mammal is that they've got free limbs that they don't always have to use for walking and stuff like that to manipulate objects.
Oh, yeah.
And that the manipulation of objects allowed them to, have advantages in the manipulation of tools and stuff like that.
Yeah. You can't help but imagine, like, what if this had been the successful limb of evolutionary ascension, and then you ended up with all of these different like mono-limbed creatures, plowing about in the seas, climbing up onto land, and maybe getting to the point where they're using that one spiky tentacle to type on computer keyboards.
Yeah, you see it in octopi too.
These free
limbs that they can manipulate things with. I wonder, could Opabinia, if it hadn't gone extinct, could it have become the tool-using creature before there were even mammals?
Yeah, but instead it just remains this weird dead end that looks like if you decided to make an animal out of random Lego pieces, and you stuck that I think they still have that sort of twisty grabber mechanism in the Lego kits today. All right, the next creature on our list here is the Hallucigenia.
Hallucigenia, well named.
Yeah, it almost doesn't need a cool nickname, but I know you have one thought up already.
How about the creeping headless spike worm?
Yes. Yeah, that's because that works, because we're essentially looking at a tube of flesh with two rows of spines on one side and one row of mouth-tipped tentacles on the other.
Okay.
And on either end, if we're just, keep in mind here, we're working from the fossils here. On either end, there's kind of a dark stain.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably one of them is the head. And presumably the idea here is that, or at least the early idea is that it walked about on those spines and it waved its tentacles above it. So you had this stilt walking tentacle waver, something with no modern, analogy.
No.
No modern analog. It looks like something that you would see illustrated in a Wayne Barlow alien, book, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Or like something, I don't know, it looks kind of like one of those blobs that sometimes shows up in a Gary Larson cartoon when he's just trying to create a weird alien shape.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like something that would come out of a dream, thus its name. You know, it's hallucigenia. It's something that is that seems like a fever dream brought to life in a fossil.
Now, I think this was first put together by paleontologists in the 70s, right?
Right. And then they had there was a subsequent find from China that showed a similar creature with a second row of tentacles tipped with claws. And then they realized, oh, we have it upside down. The creature walked on the tentacles, and the spikes provided an upward-facing protective array. So that's a lot. I mean, it's still a weird-looking critter, don't get me wrong, but that's a lot more in keeping as what we might expect. You know, that's not that different from, say, a turtle with legs on the bottom and the protective display on top, or any, you know, various examples from the invertebrate world.
I don't know. Is that less weird? I'm trying to think. Okay, so it's like a worm, and it's got these long tentacles with mouths on them that it walks on.
Yeah, I mean, it's still weird.
And it's got spikes sticking up. Okay, yeah, I guess a little less weird than walking on the spikes.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a fun experiment you can play. Anytime you see like a crazy alien illustration, try to decide, is it more alien if you turn it upside down? Because, yeah, you can either improve upon the design or figure out how they came up with it to begin with, maybe. All right, so let's talk about it a little bit more here. So University of Durham invertebrate paleontologist Martin R. Smith, who is an interesting chap. He has a nice online presence.
Yeah.
He placed the fossil of one of these creatures in an electron microscope in an attempt to, you know, figure out more about it. And one of the pressing questions was, namely, which end is the head and which one is the anus?
Well, yeah, I mean, that sort of, I knew there was some problem with locating its head, and that comes through in my nomenclature of it, the headless.
Right.
Spike worm.
Now, we mentioned the stains earlier, right? Like basically from the fossils, we knew that there was like a big stain on one end and a smaller stain on the other, and one was presumably the head. So the larger stain was for a long time interpreted as a balloon-like head on this creature. But it turns out it was very much a stain. It was the quote, decay fluids that had been squeezed out of one end of the guts of the organism.
Gross.
Yeah, so this was the anus, and the head was on the other side. And when they looked to the head, you know what they found?
Hockey mask.
Close. They found a smiley face.
No way.
Yeah, a pair of eyes with a semicircular grin. So it was sort of like a caterpillar looking creature.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, when I say smiley face, it's kind of abstract. I'm looking at an image of it here, but we can't help but look at it with our human failings and say, oh, well, that's a smiley face.
Oh, hallucigenia, you devil, you.
Yeah. So hallucigenia is a fun one for sure.
Stealing my heart. Take me somewhere even weirder, Robert.
All right. Well, the next one is Wiwaxia.
Oh boy!
And I believe did you come up with a name for this one, or did I?
I think this was you.
Okay. I think I actually came up with a few different ones here. So it looks kind of like a prehistoric Iron Maiden. It also looks like an organic battle helm, or perhaps a grimdark Pokemon. And it provides another splash of the bizarre to the Cambrian seas. So two rows of long spines and a kind of plate mail armor of leaf-shaped ribbed plates, again, on something that looks like a hat. It looks like a spiked hat, like plate mail kind of scenario. I can't stress the armor analogy enough.
You know, kind of like a half of a walnut with plate mail on it and knives sticking out.
Yeah, it looks like something an orc would wear on its head. And a lot of the fossils here are essentially – that we have of this thing are essentially flattened remains of this natural armor because, again, it's the hard parts that we're left with, and we just have to try and interpret what the soft tissue would have consisted of. And there are different interpretations here. Now, Martin Smith, who I just mentioned earlier, he favors the mollusk interpretation. He says that their mouths, which would have been a radula bearing two rows of teeth, have several similarities with the teeth of modern mollusks. And they look nothing like worm teeth, because that's the other argument, is that these are essentially worm creatures. Specifically, they would be bristle worms, but that's more of a controversial interpretation.
Huh.
So there's not a lot of depth for that particular organism other than it just looks really strange. And when you see illustrations of the Cambrian Sea, you will often find it'll get in there somewhere. It won't be the central organism, but it will have a place in the illustration.
Now, I've got a question, Robert.
Yes.
Among this ancient Cambrian monster house, this sea full of bizarre alien creatures, we have to imagine that modern-day life forms can trace their roots back to organisms that inhabited these oceans, especially when you think about very successful modern phyla-like vertebrates.
Yeah, because the whole idea here is not that like everything dies off and life begins anew. Some of these models would have descendants alive today, albeit, you know, rather different to organisms.
Right.
And we have just such a case with Pacaya.
Though it's a controversial example, right?
Yes. Yeah. This is not set in stone, though the fossils, of course, are. you referred to this as the ancestor fish slug, or a potential ancestor. So if you're not looking at an image of this creature, imagine a sea slug that swims like a modern fish, and you've got a clear vision of Pacaya, or at least as clear a vision as anyone. The crazy thing about it is that scientists point to its notochord, a precursor to the spinal cord, and also a key aspect of this creature's swimming mechanics, as a reason that it could just be an ancestor of all vertebrates, including humans. But we're also throwing a curve in all this because it has a two-lobed head.
Oh, that doesn't sound like any vertebrates I've ever heard of.
Yeah, scientists remain split on this. Now, a 1999 discovery of a primitive fish in the Lower Cambrian also suggests that it and Pacaya had an even more ancient common ancestor.
Okay, so it might be that this thing wasn't a direct ancestor of existing vertebrates, but that it might have been an offshoot of whatever was a direct ancestor of living vertebrates.
Right. And I think it'll make a great Halloween costume for anyone out there who's not sold on the previous specimens.
Grandma fish slug.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can just imagine it moving. Like you get used to seeing footage of sea slugs and similar creatures and the way they move. But this would have moved, if I'm reading it correctly, more like a fish, more like an eel. So
yeah.
Imagine like an eel slug, and that's what you have here.
Totally. Now, there's one more I thought would be good to mention because it's got a slightly Lovecraftian face, right?
Oh, yeah.
Leoncoilia, the blind whip hunter.
Yes. It looks kind of – this one's kind of hard to explain, really. But, it looks shrimpy. It looks a little flea-like. But imagine a blind monster that stumbles around in the murk, just bullwhipping everything in its vicinity with flails, and
yeah,
then just really whipping the heck out of potential prey.
So whips coming out of its face.
Yes. And that's what we have with Leoncoilia. Now, we assume it was blind because we haven't found evidence of eye stalks yet, which and the thing, of course, is that given these previous examples, it's entirely likely that could occur. At some point, a future fossil find will reveal, they did have eye structures and they look like this. But for the time being, the idea is that they were seemingly blind. The creature here was about 2 inches long, and it's usually classified as an arthropod, though sometimes it's thrown into the arachnomorph subgroup, which would connect it, more to scorpions and trilobites. But still, it's a fascinating creature to try and imagine, especially in this changing time where eyesight is coming online for various organisms and new methods of exploiting other organisms are becoming possible. And this one is just whipping things with its face until it can eat something.
Yeah. So I guess that's going to have to conclude our tour of the Cambrian monsters. But I do want to ask you, Robert. So clearly we have not exhausted all of the fascinating questions about the Cambrian period and the emergence of biodiversity, animal biodiversity, especially in the Cambrian period. So I want to ask you which of the Cambrian explosion theories we've discussed today appeals to you the most. Obviously, we haven't covered all the possibilities. There are other possible explanations out there. But what strikes true to you? Like, what sounds right? Could it have been sight as the thing that triggered all of this biodiversity, or the innovation of predation and carnivory, or the chemistry for biomineralization? Or is it just this sampling bias where, you know, maybe that there isn't as much bioinnovation in this period as it seems just from the fossil record?
I mean, I guess I could play it safe and say a little bit of all of those. But yeah. But I guess I tend to buy more into the predation and sight arguments with some support by some of the additional arguments. But those are the two that I guess feel like they have the most meat for me. But then again, I'm not a scientist, specializing in this time period.
Right.
But those are the ones that I feel like are the most. Maybe it's just calling to the 5-year-old in me.
Oh yeah.
It's the explanation that involves creatures warring with each other and battling each other, and therefore that's the one that I can imagine.
Yeah, it's hard to resist. Now I know I think I read at some point that one of the arguments against the sight hypothesis is just that sight doesn't generally matter in the water, and especially in the deep water, as much as it does on land. I mean, not that it doesn't matter at all, it does, but that, things like smell and hearing and stuff like that are more useful in the ocean. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure which I'm most convinced by. The predation one seems very interesting to me, that if animals weren't really capitalizing on getting their energy from other more large-sized animals before, and suddenly they started doing that, that could be, you know, a game changer.
It's also kind of an original sin type scenario too. It feels very mythic, right? Like the first creature to figure out that it can prey on its fellow organisms. And how does that occur? Like, obviously, it's not just a situation of one day this creature just takes a bite out of another one. Like, it's going to be a more gradual process, and likely begins with some sort of gray area of competition for food.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, a creature, it becomes adept at stealing food from another, maybe stealing food from its mouth.
Yeah.
Then what happens if you steal food from another creature's belly?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I mean, that is the difficulty of this hypothesis, is you have to imagine what's the process that gets you there by gradual evolutionary change.
Right.
Even if it's geologically rapid, it still would have been gradual in biological terms. Trying to, you know, go from an organisms that are all basically vegetarian to some organisms eating other animals.
Yeah, yeah. Like, another example that comes to mind is, of course, animals that will consume their own young or their own eggs.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about, you know, the parental cannibalism to sort of reabsorb essentially lost energy.
Yeah.
And how that could seemingly be an avenue into the into predation.
Yeah.
Because if you're absorbing your own biomatter back into yourself, then it becomes less of a leap to absorb the biomatter of another.
I can also see a scavenging to predation route, that maybe the gradual changes that allow you to better and better extract nutrition from dead animals that you find on the bottom of the ocean could eventually become useful in killing live animals.
Right. Right. Or you could just always do it and an angel told you not to until a snake suggested otherwise. Just another possibility.
That could be it. Well, Robert, I don't get the feeling that we're done with the Cambrian period. I think we may come back here in the future to explore some other scientific issues, and there may be other things to discuss with the Burgess Shale as well.
Yeah. And in general, I'd love to do some more episodes in the future regarding prehistoric creatures. I feel like this is something we come back to time and time again.
Well,
at least on a bi-monthly kind of pattern.
I guess so. I mean, it's the 7-year-old in me. I've never gotten over how much I love dinosaurs and other weird organisms that don't exist today. It's part of my love for monsters, and mm-hmm. it's part of what keeps bringing me back to paleontology.
All right. Well, we'll leave it at that. But in the meantime, definitely check out stufftoblowyourmind.com. I'll check out the landing page for this episode because, again, I'm going to try to include images, illustrations of fossil representations, whatever I can find for each of the organisms presented here so you can have some additional visual idea of what we're talking about. And I'll include links back to some of our other episodes that have dealt with prehistoric organisms.
And if you want to get in touch with us directly with feedback about this episode or any other, or to suggest a future episode topic, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.